as we know, Republicans in particular have been sounding the alarm, creating a red scare around China.
So can you answer that question? You are now on the new Select Committee on China. Are we seeing a kind of convergence right now of an anti-China hysteria, as well as this deep concern about protecting children? All of this brought out yesterday, but all being laid on TikTok. The Boston Globe has an editorial today saying that the answer is not going after TikTok, but regulating these social media companies.
Well, Amy, there are two different points. If we want to protect our young kids and teenagers, absolutely we need broader social media reform. One-third of American teenage girls have contemplated suicide. One of the causes of that is their addiction to social media, which is like the worst experience in junior high on steroids often. And so I have called for having a standard that these social media platforms need to consider the harm to adolescents, and the FTC should be regulating them. They shouldn't be able to have algorithms that get people addicted or that cause mental or emotional harm. That has to be broad-based on all social media. But TikTok genuinely has separate concerns, and there are two concerns. One is, frankly, reciprocity. China does not allow Twitter, Facebook, Amazon, Google, YouTube, any American company to even have the slightest entrance into China. So if we're going to have trade, there has to be reciprocity of trade. The second point is that there is evidence that TikTok, while they have not compromised American data, have had Chinese CCP officials in the app and prioritized or deprioritized information about human rights with the Uyghurs, prioritized or deprioritized information that the Chinese Communist government wants about sensitive human rights and other issues. What if the Chinese Communist Party were to do to TikTok what they did to Jack Ma or other tech leaders in China? I think those are legitimate concerns, and that is not hysteria. I've affirmed the One China policy, and I've said that we need to be tough on trade, but also still have dialogue. But it seems to me an unnecessary risk to have the CCP have control in any way over ByteDance and TikTok.
You recently traveled to Taiwan, where you met with the Taiwanese president, Tsai Ing-wen. How concerned are you that these congressional visits could further escalate tension between the United States and China, and also the United States pledging hundreds of millions of dollars of weapons to Taiwan? At the same time, President Biden is drawing a line in the sand when it comes to China militarily supporting Russia in the Ukraine war.
Well, it depends on, I think, what members of Congress say when they go to Taiwan. I was struck that the president of Taiwan, President Tsai, and the KMT, which is more sympathetic to the Chinese mainland, and the TPP all had converged on a simple policy, and that is they wanted Taiwan to be prepared for its defense. The Taiwanese have moved conscription from 4 months to 12 months. They wanted aid with defense from the United States. But at the same time, they recognize that 40% of Taiwanese exports are to the mainland of China. And they wanted an affirmation of the One China policy, which is that the situation between Taiwan and China should be resolved through peaceful dialogue between both parties, and then affirmation of the status quo. And my view is, as long as we operate under that framework, as long as our policy is not getting ahead of Taiwan, then we can still have peace in that region while being strong and standing up for the values of democracy and freedom that Taiwan represents.
Let's go directly to the Ukraine war, but on Capitol Hill. Peace activists with the group Code Pink repeatedly interrupted the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken Wednesday as he testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. This is Code Pink founder Medea Benjamin.
The American people don't want to keep fueling a proxy war with Russia that could lead us to World War III or a nuclear holocaust. You're supposed to be a diplomat start negotiating. You know, if you don't like the Chinese proposal, where is your peace proposal?
So that's peace activist Medea Benjamin. If you could respond to what she's saying, where are the negotiations? China has put forward a peace plan. Where is the Biden administration peace plan being put forward? Do you think the Biden administration is doing enough to find a way to negotiate an end to this war?
I actually respect both what President Biden and Secretary Blinken have done to mitigate the risks of nuclear war. The president has been quite judicious in not wanting to escalate tensions with the Soviet Union. When Putin was threatening nuclear weapons, the president did not respond in kind. He has been cautious, criticized by Republicans on the Hill in not having weapons to Ukraine that would be offensive, that would have any risk of getting into Russian territory. Where I think China has missed the opportunity for global leadership is they have still not denounced Putin's clear aggression and war in Ukraine. I mean, they have no legitimacy, in my view, to offer a peace plan if they are unwilling to say what Putin did was wrong. And if Xi Jinping is meeting with Putin over 40 times in the last decade and saying he's one of our closest friends and unwilling to criticize what Putin did, that does not give them much of a moral legitimacy for a peace plan. I think where we should have a peace plan is clearly saying that Putin was wrong. It was unprovoked. We want to have the territorial sovereignty of Ukraine and stand up for Ukraine, but we need to have at the same time dialogue. And you may have countries like India or others that could be better brokers. Now, India at least has condemned Putin's invasion. But my view of it is that we have to support Ukraine while working at the same time to keep the channels of dialogue open to have some just peace. And I was fine and supported Secretary Blinken meeting Lavrov in India. We should continue the dialogue while saying that Putin was clearly in the wrong in this case.
Finally, we just have 30 seconds, but President Biden has approved the massive ConocoPhillips oil and gas development in Alaska. The $7 billion Willow Project expected to produce 180,000 barrels of oil per day, adding some 240 million metric tons of greenhouse gas pollution to the atmosphere over 30 years. You're a congressmember from California. You certainly know the effects of the climate catastrophe, and not just in California and Malawi and Madagascar, all over the world. Your response to this approval?
It's a colossal mistake by the administration. It is a carbon bomb. There is no justification for it. It's undermining the very goals of the Inflation Reduction Act, the largest climate package. It is going to be alienating young voters, the very voters that admired the president's work on climate and on student debt relief. I have advocated very strongly, as have many progressives, that this is just a wrong decision. It's a mistake, and it sends a horrible message to young voters and climate activists around the country.
Silicon Valley Congressmember Ro Khanna, Congressmember from California, Deputy Whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, as well as on the House Select Committee on China. Thank you so much for being with us. When we come back, investigative journalist James Bamford reveals how Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu clandestinely tried to help Donald Trump get elected in 2016. Why don't we know more about this? Stay with us. Song by the Palestinian singer and songwriter Rasha Nahas. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As mass protests rock Israel against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his plan to overhaul Israel's judiciary, We turn now to look at how Netanyahu secretly tried to help Donald Trump win the 2016 election. That's the focus of a new cover story in The Nation headlined The Candidate and the Spy. Longtime award-winning investigative journalist James Bamford reveals Netanyahu dispatched a secret Israeli agent to the United States in the spring of 2016 to meet with advisors to Trump and offer to share secret intelligence with the campaign against Hillary Clinton. The story is based in part on a series of text messages sent by the Israeli secret agent to Trump advisor Roger Stone. In one message from August 12, 2016, the agent wrote, quote, "Roger, hello from Jerusalem. Any progress? He's going to be defeated unless we intervene. We have critical intel. The key is in your hands," the text read. Later, the agent wrote, quote, "October surprise is coming." James Bamford writes, quote, "While the American media and political system fixated on Russian President Vladimir Putin and his armies of cyber warriors, trolls and bots, what was completely missed in the Russiagate investigation of 2016 was the Israeli connection. No details of it were ever revealed in the heavily redacted Mueller report or in the Senate Intelligence Committee report." James Bamford joins us now from Washington, D.C., author of many books, his latest, Spy Fail, Foreign Spies, Mole Saboteurs, and the Collapse of America's Counterintelligence. Jim, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Take us on this journey. Talk about what happened, why we know a lot about Russia, or at least a lot is made of in going after Russia, saying it tried to overthrow the 2016 election or spin it for Trump. What actually is documented here is Israel's involvement. And yet Mueller report, Senate Intelligence Committee, it looks like they knew but just didn't want to talk about it.
Well, exactly. The documents I got are from the FBI. There are the FBI affidavit about this. There's documents, numerous quotes from the secret agent, the Israeli secret agent sent by Netanyahu, talking about the PM, which the FBI agent indicates was the prime minister, and lays out a months-long plot, basically, from May of 2016 till the fall of 2016, right up to the election. This was investigated by the Mueller team. It was the Mueller team, the Mueller FBI agents, who actually got a search warrant for the secret agent's communications. And that's what these documents are. These are the basis of that investigation from the FBI and the Mueller team. But all this was redacted from the final Mueller report. All they focused on was Russia, and in the end, they basically gave Russia a bill of health. They said that there was no collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. They left out a little bit from the report, and that's that there was collusion, but it was from Netanyahu and Israel to the Trump campaign, and it went on for months and months, and involved providing the Trump campaign with secret access to the information that the Russians were picking up from Hillary Clinton's campaign and the DNC. In other words, the Israelis, they have a very, very sophisticated eavesdropping organization, Unit 8200. It's their equivalent of the NSA. And they were eavesdropping on the Russians and eavesdropping on WikiGate, and they were and Julian Assange, and they were picking up all this information that the Russians were getting from the Clinton campaign and the DNC. And rather than giving it to the President of the United States, to Obama, which is what an ally is supposed to do, especially one that gets $4 billion a year, they instead were giving it to the Trump campaign, secretly giving it to the Trump campaign in order to get concessions from Trump when he became president, and hopefully they were going to help make him president.
Let's talk about that moment, why this was so critical for Netanyahu. Talk about the quartet, the direction Obama and the quartet were going in, and why Netanyahu wanted Trump to win.
Well, a key reason he wanted Trump to win was because Trump vowed to throw out the nuclear agreement with Iran that the Obama administration had worked very hard on and was very useful to the United States. And Netanyahu didn't like it. He didn't want it. He wanted Trump to get rid of it, and Trump was planning to do that. But he wanted a second thing, too. The Obama administration was putting a great deal of pressure on Netanyahu to work out an agreement with the Palestinians over Jerusalem, which is divided. The final agreement over Jerusalem was going to be divided between the Palestinians and Israel. Israel wanted, Netanyahu wanted the entire city to be Israeli. And so they were putting pressure on the Trump campaign, saying, look, this is what we want, and we can help Trump get elected, but we have to have a, basically have to have an agreement that he's going to help us on this issue over the sovereignty of Jerusalem. And in the very end, that's what happened. There was a secret meeting, or at least a private meeting, in the Trump penthouse in New York, just between Netanyahu and Trump. And after it was over, Trump came out, and that's what he said. He said that if I'm elected president, I'm going to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem and declare Jerusalem the capital of Israel. So the Israelis got what they wanted, and Trump got what he wanted, and the American public was screwed in the meantime.
Jim Bamford, in your piece, The Candidate and the Spy, you write, although the affidavit did not specify any individual defendants, the numerous potential criminal charges laid out in the FBI documents spoke to the seriousness of the Israeli plot. They included violation of the foreign contributions ban, which prohibits foreigners from contributing money or something of value to federal, state, or local elections. Other charges included aiding and abetting conspiracy, wire fraud, attempted conspiracy to commit wire fraud. Still another charge, unauthorized access to a protected computer, indicates Israel may have conducted illegal hacking operations. Can you talk more about this? And the man who is the spy in that title of your piece, married to, what, Netanyahu's cousin?
Well, yeah, they don't name the spy. The spy's name is redacted, but there are a lot of similarities with one of Trump's closest associates, Isaac Mohel. And he's a very shadowy character. He's described as very discreet. And Netanyahu sends him on secret missions various places. So I just mentioned that that happens to be a very close associate who goes on secret missions for Netanyahu, at least according to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, a well-known and highly respected Haaretz. So he's a candidate, but I don't know if he was the secret agent or not. I'm just mentioning him as one of the people that Netanyahu does send out on secret missions. So, you know, I think it would be very important for the U.S. government to identify this person who is trying to interfere and throw the election in favor of Trump.
You also comment that it's not only the United States that the Netanyahu government was involved with trying to interfere with the elections. You talk about Latin America, Africa. Talk about this Archimedes group.
Well, just to back up a little bit, just recently, in the last few weeks, there was an enormous investigation that was revealed throughout much of the world, actually. And it was an eight-month investigation by journalists from some of the most respected newspapers in the world, including Haaretz in Israel, País in Spain, The Observer and The Guardian in London, Der Spiegel in Germany, and French newspaper. Anyway, it was an enormous investigation, went on for 8 months, and the focus was Israel interfering in elections around the world. And they came out with an enormous amount of detail, including undercover investigations of Israeli activity trying to overthrow, or rather throw elections in Latin America, Africa, and according to one of the members of the group, in the United States. So this has been going on for a very long time. It basically identified Israel as the world's center for election interference and or secret election interference. And Archimedes Group was one of those companies earlier on, before this investigation, that was identified as a company that Israel was using to, or at least it was a private company with ties to the Israeli intelligence, that was using a lot of fraud and other aspects to throw elections in various parts of the world. I think there were 13 countries or something it was involved in. So this has been going on for a long time. Israel's been involved in enormous amounts of covert operations and intelligence operations in the U.S. just in the last 7 years. Half my book deals with Israeli intelligence and covert operations in the United States. But there is a determination by all parties involved, the administration, Congress, and the mainstream media, to completely use blinders when it comes to Israel.
So finally, while the U.S. media fixated on Russian interference in the 2016 election, another campaign to influence the outcome by Israel went unreported. That was 2016. Now we're moving in the 2024 election. And you have the prime minister of Israel is again Benjamin Netanyahu. And again, President Trump is running for president. Your final thoughts, Jim?
Well, it's going to be a deja vu all over again. It's going to be a repeat, since we have the same players in the same positions and the same media that pays no attention to anything that Israel does that's questionable in the United States, and the Congress and the administration that completely turn a blind eye to Israeli intelligence. So, yeah, we're here again, and it just can repeat itself with the same players doing the same play all over again, unless there is congressional investigation or hard-hitting reporting by the mainstream media and further investigation by the FBI.
Well, Jim Bamford, we want to have you back on to talk about your book, but we want to thank you so much for being with us now. James Bamford, longtime investigative journalist, will link to your new cover story for The Nation, The Candidate and the Spy. We end today's show with an update on protests against Cop City in Atlanta and a dramatic hearing Thursday where a judge denied bond for many of the people jailed since March 5th when they were indiscriminately arrested at a music festival against the proposed police training facility would be the largest in the country. It's in the Wilani Forest and accused of vandalism and arson at a construction site a mile away. They're charged with domestic terrorism based on evidence like muddy clothes. One of those arrested was longtime New York City activist Priscilla Grimm, an editor of the Occupied Wall Street Journal, whose daughter, Sophia, told The Independent, "We're so grateful and appreciative for all the support we have received. It's made things so much less stressful." For an update, we're joined by Micah Herskin, a local community organizer in Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Micah, talk about these charges of domestic terrorism and who is being held in jail and not released on bond.
Absolutely. So at the end of the day, these charges are political prosecution. So 23 people were arrested at the Wilani Forest Festival. This was at the very beginning of the week of action. As you said, there was an action that happened about a mile away from this site. And instead of showing up to that site, police showed up at this music festival where people were enjoying music, you know, having a good time, and mass arrested people. Now, ever since March 5th, there were 22 people being held in jail without bond. Just yesterday, they had new bond hearings where about 12 folks got out earlier because on consent bonds, which means they didn't have to pay. 8 people were denied bond yesterday, and 2 people were granted $25,000 bonds. The folks who were denied bond were, you know, not denied bond for any specific evidence other than, as you said, having, you know, mud on their clothes and their shoes, you know, having wet pants. You know, we've seen earlier affidavits and warrants that have said that folks are known members of a prison abolitionist movement. And so at the end of the day, you know, these are really just about trying to repress this social movement that is trying to stop Cop City.
And this is a social movement that goes across the spectrum in Atlanta, right? I mean, you've got religious people, you've got environmentalists who are fighting this, you've got indigenous people who are fighting this, and you have people who are deeply concerned about issues of police brutality who are fighting this. And then you have the recent police killing of Tortuguita, who was one of the activists, and an independent autopsy just came out that suggested that Tortuguita was sitting cross-legged with their hands in the air when they were shot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so you know, the state has yet to release its autopsy still, even though, you know, we're now months out from this killing. But this independent autopsy showed, you know, Tortuguita's mother, speaking at a press conference, sat down and showed the position that this autopsy found that her child was killed in, which was essentially, you know, looking like this, sitting cross-legged. You know, there were bullets through their palms. And so, yeah, you know, the more information that comes out, the clearer it is that, you know, just as these prosecutions are political prosecutions, the killing of Tortuguita was a political assassination where police marched into the forest and killed somebody and then, you know, most likely lied to cover it up.
The Independent's John Tarleton reported that the conditions in the DeKalb County Jail Women's Unit are poor, Sophia said, one of the daughters of those being held. Sparse food, overflowing toilets, no personal visits due to short staffing, paid telephone, video call services that barely function, transgender SDs being assigned to areas that don't correspond to their gender. The men's unit reported to be even worse, she said. Your thoughts on how people are able to communicate? And, you know, we just did a story. We interviewed Ben Crump about the 10 people, seven of them police officers, who were arrested on murder charges for killing a mentally challenged man at a hospital in Virginia. They're out on bond. These activists are charged with domestic terrorism and continue to be held.
Yes. They're, you know, they're being held, and again, you know, really without evidence. During these bond hearings, it was clear that, you know, the prosecution has not yet put together any case. They're, you know, using these fallbacks. You know, one of the examples that they gave was that people were wearing black, and that was evidence of playing on the team, of, you know, being on the side of the protest. And so, you know, the charges are all really shaky. There's really no legitimate evidence that's been put forward. In terms of the jail conditions, you know, right now, this is true across the country, but especially in Atlanta, across the metro Atlanta area, our jails are in absolute crisis. There are jail deaths happening, you know, across the metro area really frequently. The DeKalb County Jail, you know, many parts don't have running water is what we're hearing from inside. Toilets are broken. There are freezing temperatures. And, you know, despite all of that, there have been vigils that organizers have been hosting outside of the jail as a way to communicate with folks inside. Shortly after their arrests, there was a large vigil that was planned and things were projected on the jail and folks were able to yell across the walls of the jail. A father of someone who had been arrested was able to speak directly to his child. And so there have also been really beautiful moments of solidarity and folks on the outside making sure that, you know, we're supporting folks inside.
Micah Herskin, I want to thank you for being with us, local community organizer in Atlanta, Georgia. I want to thank you so much for being with us. That does it for our show. On Monday, Democracy Now's Juan Gonzalez is moderating an online panel on Chicago's 2023 mayoral race, reclaiming Harold Washington's multiracial coalition. Details at democracynow.org. And a very happy birthday to Nermeen Sheikh. Also, Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnock, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Sanji Lopez. Our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Beck Staley, Dennis Moynihan, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to Looking at Lyme on CJSF's Speak Up, and I'm your host, Sarah Cormode. Looking at Lyme is a podcast all about Lyme disease. My own journey back to health motivated me to understand the complexities of the illness, testing, diagnosis, and treatment. In each episode, you'll hear from experts in the field of medicine, science, and outdoor education. Together, we learn about topics such as neuroplasticity, pain management, co-infections, outdoor safety, and tick surveillance. You can find out more by visiting our website, lookingatlime.ca, or following us on Twitter or Instagram. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to hear new episodes.